Welcome everyone to today's Clue and Internet Seminar. Again, my name is Jean Bounce. I'm here at the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll help to moderate our Internet Seminar, which has been sponsored by the same group here at EPA. Our session today will look at mining-influenced water, specifically examining treatment technologies. I'll be joined by a co-moderator, Michelle Mahoney. I'll let Michelle introduce our speakers and our instructors in just a few moments, but before we begin the technical portion of our broadcast, I'm going to go ahead and cover a few housekeeping items and reminders so that everybody's comfortable with how the session will run and you know how to use the new tools. So I'm looking at slide number 2, our housekeeping slide. For those of you that are familiar with our Clue and Internet seminars, and I'm going to ask that we keep things off of the full screen and click a button on my end to actually change a view here. We'll turn that back in just a moment if you need it. Just a reminder, the entire session today is actually going to be broadcast using a brand new tool on Adobe Connect. Our seminar today will run very similar to a Clue-In event, except it's going to be a little bit more interactive. So if you're joining us for the first time for a session delivered on Clue-In through Adobe Connect, I hope you'll find this to be a very enjoyable experience. Our entire seminar is going to be delivered live and in real time through Adobe. You'll be able to actually watch as our presenters move through the materials at their own pace. So rather than having to manually turn the page as you used to have to do for Clue-In, you'll actually be able to watch them as they turn and move through the slides. If you have chosen to download the slides in advance and have only dialed in on the phone line, there will be some elements of the interactive portion that you'll miss out on, so I encourage you to try to join us live in the Adobe Connect room. If you haven't done so already, go back to the seminar confirmation messages and reminder emails you would have received and click the button that says Go to Seminar. That'll actually prompt you to check in, allow you to identify yourself and anyone else with you, and then allow you to come into the online broadcast in Adobe Connect. By default for all participants, the audio is actually going to be streamed online through Adobe Connect. You should be able to hear me through your computers or mobile device. If the volume online sounds too low, I'd encourage you to first check your local volume settings. You may actually just need to manually increase your speaker volume. You might even need to go into your sound control panel and boost the speaker output. Sometimes simply wearing a pair of headphones can help with that online audio stream. If you have problems with the online audio, we do have call-in information. We'll be happy to share that with anybody who needs it. You can use the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen, to actually type up a request, and we'll be happy to share the call-in information with you privately. For those of you that have dialed us in on the phones, we have globally muted all the lines, and we ask that you remain on that global mute to help cut down on background noises and disruptions. Again, we will be taking time for Q&A with our presenters. You guys are encouraged to actually type up your questions electronically using that Q&A window in the lower right corner. You can type them up at any point in time, but we'll queue them up and hold them until we take a designated break. And at that point, Michelle and I will read them out loud so our presenters can actually answer them. Our entire session today is being recorded, and you will automatically receive an email note as soon as that archive is available for free replay online. If you like the seminar series and are interested in learning more, we do have nearly 500 archive sessions available for free replay online through the Clue-In website. Just a quick screenshot of what everybody should be seeing to kind of give you guys a sense of how much more interactive we are. All of our participants will be able to see the slides live and in real time here in the main portion of their window. You may find if the slides are too small, each individual participant can actually click what's called a full screen button. And the full screen button looks like this. It appears in the upper right corner of the window showing the slides. And that will actually expand the slides up to take up your full screen. If you want to turn that view off, simply press the full screen button again. That'll bring you back down into the normal environment. To the right of the slide, you'll see our Sponsored by Clue-In logo and that very important Q&A window in the lower right corner. Simply type your comments, questions, or report any technical difficulties here, press the little cartoon bubble to the right, or hit enter, and that will privately submit them into our queue. And we'll either work with you to help troubleshoot the issues or, again, queue up your questions to ask them when we take a designated break with our instructors. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's broadcast. So, again, I thank everybody, if you're on the phones, to remain on mute. For those of you streaming the audio online, I hope that it's working for you. If you need any help, use that Q&A window to request it. And Michelle, I'll go ahead and turn things over to you on your overview slide.
Great. Thank you so much, Jean. I appreciate you going through the housekeeping for us. So today's webinar, as you can see on slide number 4, is going to be about mine-influenced water treatment technologies. And some of you may know this is the third in a series of webinars that my office, the Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, has been delivering, and we continue to keep this a series and plan on having webinars about every 4 months. You can look at the previous two in the series on Clue-In as it was archived. These webinars are basically intended to serve as a source of relevant and current information on the environmental issues associated with active, closed, and abandoned mining sites, as well as the technologies available for treatment. Today's webinar is going to focus on the treatment of mining-influenced water. This is the second webinar we've had on this topic. The previous one in the series was held on September 19, 2012, and that included presentations on PCBs at mining sites, a tool available to help estimate the cost of abatement for water pollution caused by acid mine drainage, and a case study on acid rock drainage remediation at the Berkeley Pit Lake site in Montana. So those, as I mentioned, those webinars are available through our CLUIN archives, which you can find at the CLUIN website. Today, we're going to provide an overview of passive treatment technologies, and we're going to feature several case studies in both the eastern and western United States. We're going to start with a very brief presentation by me. I'm going to talk about a study that my office is doing to identify and evaluate mining-influenced water treatment technologies that are being employed at both active and abandoned mining sites. Then we're going to have Brady Gouda give us a general overview of acid mine drainage and discuss the implementation of five passive treatment installations at the Lambert Run watershed in West Virginia. Brady will be followed by Jim Gusick, who's going to compare the advantages and disadvantages of various passive treatment components and also provide an introduction to the wide range of remediation design options available to practitioners of passive treatment. And then finally, our webinar today will end with Kevin Mayer, who's going to wrap us up with a presentation on three different treatment systems that are currently operating at the Leviathan Mine Superfund site on the eastern slope of the Sierra Nevada mountain range in California. So with that introduction, I think we'll move to beginning our session today. As I mentioned, I'm just going to go through a little bit of information and give you a general overview of a study that my office is doing, basically developing a report on mine-influenced water treatment technologies. Basically, we've initiated this effort because we want to evaluate the mine-influenced water treatment technologies that are being used and develop the materials to help support the selection of appropriate and cost-effective treatment technologies. Mine influenced water at mine sites comes from mine drainage, processed water, and stormwater, and needs to be characterized to determine the regulatory constraints and potential source control, treatment, metal recovery, and other management options. And we at EPA want to evaluate these treatment technologies that are both existing and also innovative ones, to look at their treatment effectiveness and limitations, their cost to implement, and the applicability of these treatments. My office is also intending for the developed materials to further inform decision makers about the diverse technologies available for mine-influenced water treatment, as well as better understand the importance of weighing the upfront installation costs with the long-term operation and maintenance of various technologies. This slide shows you the key information that we are looking at in technologies that we're finding. And basically, we're identifying technologies that are being employed at both active and abandoned mining sites. And then we're researching this key information that you see on the slide. We want to identify the mine-influenced water treatment technologies being used for site-specific cleanup goals and issues. We want to identify which mine sites have mining-influenced water treatment, what's the treatment technology effectiveness, determine the use appropriateness of specific technologies. For example, are they being used for metal removal and or recovery or solid liquid separation? We want to identify the engineering constraints and determine the cost to implement. And that includes installation, operation, and maintenance. We want to look at the treatment effectiveness and removal of toxicity, identify the byproducts from the treatment, and then also identify any additional research needs. And this table, I know it might be a little bit difficult to read, but this is how we're trying to compile the information so that it would be an easy guide for users. The information that you see in this summary table would also be complemented by some text with further information on all these technologies and describing all the key information that I presented to you on the previous slide. And essentially, EPA is looking to have the results of this research to be compiled and made available to decision makers as well as the public. And we'll be disseminating the information through a website, probably a webinar, and other to-be-determined outlets. So I just wanted to take this time to let all of you know that this information is going to be out there soon. We'll keep you up to date, and hopefully it'll be a useful tool to everyone who's joined us today. So with that, I think we're ready to move to our first presenter. Brady Guda is a project manager with the National Mineland Reclamation Center within West Virginia's Water Research Institute. Brady oversees numerous watershed restoration projects involving the installation of treatment systems designed to combat acidic and alkaline mine drainage from abandoned mine sites. He also works with federal agencies such as the Office of Surface Mining and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He works with state agencies such as the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection's Abandoned Mineland Division and Non-Point Source Program. And he also works with stakeholder groups in their respective watersheds. So welcome, Brady, and we're ready for you to deliver your presentation. And it looks like we're all loaded up and ready to go, so it's all you.
Thank you. Just want to say hello and welcome to everyone. And like she said, I'm just going to talk about one of the watersheds that we've had some success in, as well as give you kind of a brief overview of just what active mine drainage chemistry is and how we treat it. So what is AMD? Well, basically, AMD is, it occurs in sulfide minerals in rocks are exposed to oxidizing conditions. It forms when, let me go to my next slide. There's four equations that we use to decipher AMD. In equation one, what you see is that the iron sulfide is oxidized, releasing ferrous iron, sulfate and acidity. Equation two, we have the ferrous iron, which mixes with oxygen and to form ferric iron, which is the oxidized form of iron. Equation three, we take ferric iron, and it can be hydrolyzed to form ferric hydroxide and acidity, or it can act as a catalyst in generating much greater amounts of sulfate and acidity. Just kind of a brief overview of what the reactions are to generate the acidic drainage that we have to deal with. And my apologies, I have a cold today, so I'm really hoping I'm not too stuffy and you all can understand me. So how do we treat AMD? Well, we treat AMD three different ways. We use in situ treatment, we use active treatment, and we also use passive treatment. I'll be talking mostly, my talk today revolves around passive treatment, but I thought I would just give you an overview of kind of each of the respective technologies. So in situ, basically what we do is we use various chemicals, alkaline and otherwise, to treat the mine drainage actually in the mine itself. A lot of times it consists of alkaline injection of some sort, be it from fly ash or steel slag or limestone, some alkaline material. A lot of times if we have mines that are small in nature and you don't have a lot of room to work outside the constraints of the mine, this is an option. Active treatment, especially here in West Virginia, this focuses on sites that were permitted past the Smacker, which was in 1977. These projects have a capital installation, typically a doser and some settling ponds and things like that, to constantly treat the water as it comes out of the mine. But it also has an operations and maintenance component to that, to where you have constant chemical addition, labor costs from sludge removal, trucking the sludge, things like that. It's a very expensive and very intense procedure. Passive treatment, which is what I want to focus on today, basically is a theoretical one-time installation. It's designed to last a certain amount of time, typically around 20 years or so. There's some that are longer, some that are shorter. It just depends on the project site itself. Like I said, it doesn't require any type of maintenance, but we've found that that is not really the case. These things need to, as they're put in, conditions change, variables change, and we realize that we have to go in and do some additional maintenance and things. A lot of times these systems are put in acidic environments where you're going to need to use alkaline materials to raise the pH, precipitate metals, things like that. So the watershed that I'm going to talk about today is in the Lambert Run watershed, which is in Harrison County, West Virginia. located in north central West Virginia. This was a picture of the, this is the mouth of Lambert Run. You're looking at the West Fork River, which is a tributary of the Monongahela. And you can see the iron plume is coming out and going down the left side of the river there. A little bit of background on Lambert Run. It's an 8-square-mile watershed of the West Fork. Like I said, we've got some communities nearby, the town of Hepsibaw, Meadowbrook, and Spelter. Not very many folks live in this area. It's pretty sparse. Most of the land uses that we have are farming, a lot of agriculture in the area, and recently we've had a lot of push to develop the Marcellus. For those of you that know, the Marcellus is a thick shale that produces massive amounts of natural gas when fracked. I want to talk about the partners that we had on this project, and one of the themes that I'll talk about as we go through this talk is how these partners all played a role in getting these projects developed. It's really important to have lots of partnerships and going forward on these projects because it takes a team to really get these things implemented and installed. Our local stakeholder group was the Guardians of the West Fork. It was kind of a small group, just volunteers, but they were responsible for kind of really getting this thing off the ground. They assisted with project implementation, took us out, showed us some of the sites that needed to be treated, and really and helped out as far as from sampling and some of the other items that we needed to do from like landowner support, landowner contact, things like that. The West Virginia Water Research Institute, who I work for, which is the National Mineland Reclamation Center, is one of the programs in the WVWRI. We were responsible for generating the conceptual design, doing a lot of the pre- and post-monitoring, also going out and finding the funding to do these projects and working with the landowners and the engineers and the contractors and everybody it takes to get these projects implemented. Excuse me. Our two funding sources came from the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection. That was from the Nonpoint Source Program. They were a funding partner, provided lots of valuable insight, performed also project management when it came to implementing construction and some of the engineering activities. The Office of Surface Mining Reclamation, they were also a funding partner that assisted with some of the oversight from a construction and an engineering standpoint. Just some of the early collaboration to kind of illustrate how long this process it is, especially when you have a lot of folks involved. We started this program back in 2003. Guardians of the West Fork and DEP had kind of come in and established a monitoring program through the Section 319 program. 319 is the Clean Water Act funds, Nonpoint Source Clean Water Act funds that we have used that we use to implement these types of projects. So we went in, started doing a bunch of sampling, pretty much applied for the first set of project funds in 2004. Again, the funds came from EPA, passed to the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection, as well as money coming from OSM. So it's a 60-40 split to get these projects implemented. And then, you know, we had to get the stakeholder buy-in. So we had to get the landowners on board. We had to get the watershed group to make sure they were in approval before we moved forward. And so the projects that I'm going to talk about in the following slides basically went through this same process. A little bit of the geology. Lambert Run is located in the Pittsburgh mine seam. Was the mine or the coal that was mined. The Pittsburgh coal is a massive seam. It runs all the way from Fairmont clear up to Pittsburgh. It ranges anywhere from 8 to 10 feet thick, and has really been the major coal seam that's been the economic boost to this area for the last 100 years or so. Most of the mining that was in the watershed was done. Deep mining, there was a little bit of surface mining that was done, but for the most part, it was deep mining. The unique thing in this watershed is that the water chemistries that we were dealing with range from acidic to alkaline drainage. Typically, you don't see that in a lot of these watersheds. Usually, you have either acidic water or alkaline water. And when doing the 318 funds, you need to submit a watershed-based plan. This was the first watershed-based plan that we know of that was successfully submitted and approved by EPA in order to qualify to use the 319 funds. A couple of the sites that we had to deal with, these are all pre-construction pictures. The first one in the upper left, the LR6, which was, we called it the Gwynn site. We had two Pittsburgh steam portals that were just chugging out massive amounts of iron-laden acid mine drainage. The LR4, which was the Morsey, we haven't addressed this one yet. It's kind of one of the smaller actors in the watershed. We hope to achieve treatment on it with future funding. And then the picture on your right is Mainstem Lambert Run. Pretty big tributary to the West Fork, and really chugs in a lot of iron to the river. So like I said, we started in 2004 with a partnership between us, OSM, and the Guardians to start installing multiple passive treatment systems. These are the four. There's actually five that are treated. I didn't have time to put my fifth one on the map here, but it sits about right there. So hopefully y'all can see my mouse. It's right there. The first one is the Muzzleloader Club site.
Brady, this is Michelle. I just gave you a pointer because we can't see your mouse, so hopefully you see the pointer now.
Okay, real quick, Michelle, how do I move the mouse? Because I'm not being able to move the mouse. Move the arrow.
You should be able to just click on it and drag it.
No.
It's okay. Why don't you talk through it, and Michelle and I will move the mouse for you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so this is the first project that we put in. This is the Muzzleloader Club site. The fella in your picture is the president of the local stakeholder group. He had an interesting day that day. We were out sampling, and he tried to get a sample, and he's had about 4.5 feet of iron sludge. So you'll say it was an interesting afternoon. Pre-construction chemistry. And what I'll do is I'll kind of go through and I'll illustrate the pre-construction chemistry for each of these sites. Talk a little bit about the passive treatment that we installed in these systems, then we'll talk about the post-construction treatment and then how the reductions that we had and what the results were. So the first one, like I said, this is the Muzzleloader Club. The picture in the background is a adit they had cut open to allow water to drain out of the mine. All the mining that was done here was done up dip, and so when these guys would mine, they would just mine down and they would cut a hole to keep the water off of them as they worked their way down the mine. So we had about 12 tons per year of acidity, around a ton and a half or so of iron, and about a ton of aluminum with, again, a low pH around 3.5. So this is an acidic discharge. Basically what we did was we went in and we cleaned that portal up. We installed a wet seal, which allows the water to exit out of the mine and prevents anybody from trespassing or going into the mine where, you know, unsafe conditions occur. We routed the water via open limestone channel to get the water through our treatment units. We used a field site leach bed to add alkalinity. And when I get to that spot, I'll talk about that a little bit more. And then we did two treatment wetlands. One is kind of primary wetland to collect a lot of the metal solids. And then the second one was more for polishing. So this is the slag bed, the image to your on the left-hand side of the screen there. What happened was we had a source of circumneutral water, pH was around 5.5 or 6.5. The water would come in on the top. There's approximately 3.5 feet of steel slag in the bottom of that pond that you see. The water would flow down through the steel slag and come out highly charged with alkalinity. pH is up around 11 and 12. Sometimes excess of 300 milligrams per liter of alkalinity. So the idea was that we would go and take the acid mine drainage, which is coming from the right side of the picture, have it discharged down through an open limestone channel, and then we would have a mixing zone basically below the steel slag bed to where that alkaline water would mix with the acid water, and you would get precipitation of the iron and the aluminum in the effluent. Excuse me. So if you look at the picture behind the text where the white Jeep is, that was our primary settling cell where we got a majority of the metals settling out The water then came via pipe into the second wetland cell, which is what you're seeing here. We took water that had a pH of 3.5 initially, turned it around, and now we're discharging water that's got a pH of around 8. That 13 tons per year of acidity is now at 5 tons per year of alkalinity. When you see a negative tons per year, that generally indicates alkaline conditions. We've eliminated almost all of the iron coming out of here, as well as the aluminum. The property that we installed this project on is a hunting club. These fellows go out and they shoot their muzzleloaders, their guns and things. There's a small fishing pond on site. What we didn't realize after we had construction was that now we have fish living in this bottom wetland, and they're actually doing really well. We're not really sure how they got there, but we think maybe one of the local fellows in the sportsman's club transported them. So the second project I'll talk about is our Old Acre project. This was the second one, like I said, went in. This was actually one of our alkaline sites. We had fairly high pH, around 6.1, had 0.8 tons per year of acidity, but we had 17 tons per year of iron. So we didn't really need to add any alkalinity. We just needed to really oxidize and get those metals out and allow them sufficient time to settle. System design for this one, basically what we did was we had two portals we had to deal with. We had directed the drains from a northern portal to where we had sufficient room to treat, to what we call the southern portal. We had an existing kind of a breach pond that was there during mining. We put that pond back in place, turned it into a wetland, and then we had to create a second wetland to give us the additional retention time that we needed to treat the water. About the same time, we were dealing with the Army Corps. This was back in 2006 or 7. Really when the Army Corps got involved in permitting these types of projects. Since we had alkaline water, we really didn't need to add any pH. The Army Corps deemed that we needed to do some kind of BMP to make up for the loss that we would have had because we did take some stream footage out of the equation. So we did some ag BMPs, we did a cattle crossing, we did a ute tire watering trough, as well as gave the cows that were on this site a place to kind of wallow. So this is project post-construction. You can see, sorry, not to interrupt, Michelle, do I have access to the arrow now?
Yes, you should.
Oh, there, okay, great.
There you
I got
go.
It. Thank you. So the water comes out of this area right here. There's a portal kind of right back here in the hillside. The water drains out, and you can see it's highly oxidized right now. You feel that ferric iron dropping out. This is our first wetland cell. We used HDPE vinyl seawall to make the water sort of snake through the pond. It gives us additional detention time. The water then flows out of through this pipe right here and down into our second treatment wetland. And so you can see that 17 tons per year of iron is now down to less than 0.3 tons per year. The pH, we actually bumped up to 7.2. We did use some limestone in the system, which gave us additional pH lift. We're discharging almost 23.5 tons per year of alkalinity, and we've basically eliminated any of the lumens that was coming through. So these first two projects were highly successful. This was the third project that we installed. This was the Allen Meadows project. Again, this was another alkaline source. That's yours truly in the background, in case anybody's wondering. Again, like I said, it was an alkaline discharge. We had massive flows here. We had flows around 1,500 gallons per minute. Typically, you don't see in these small watersheds these big, big, big flows. What we had was, like I said, an absolute of 26.5 tons per year. Iron was 5.6 tons, and then very little aluminum. The design for this project entailed creating a channel that was basically meant just for oxidation. So what we had was wide areas where we would get lots of atmospheric interaction with the water, several roofful pools to where we would get additional oxygen introduced, and then it would drain into an initial settling pond. So the idea was there that the water would come out of this portal, basically get mixed as it goes downstream and then dumped into a settling pond with two wetlands downstream, basically capturing what metals did not get captured in the settling pond. Post-construction results, we had a pH of 7.3. Again, we took all of that acidity, neutralized it, turned it into alkalinity, knocked our, it was like, I think, 6-point-something tons per year of iron, knocked it down to 0.7, and then had basically eliminated the aluminum. So you see the common theme here is where we're taking these discharges, and we're taking them, turning it from an acidic discharge into an alkaline discharge, and then the alkaline discharges that are already alkaline, enhancing them and making them further alkaline and while removing the iron. Fourth project we put in, this is the Site 9 project, bouncing back to acidic conditions. Pre-construction chemistry, we had a pH of around, it hovered from 3.5 to 4.5, 4.8. Has lots of acidity here, 123 tons per year, with 34 tons per year of iron and 9 tons per year of aluminum. This was the largest project that we've installed in the watershed to date. But we've got plans for another project to happen next year that's gonna make this one look small. Due to the changing conditions, as we sampled this project, a little bit of background that's not on the slide, we came up with an initial conceptual design that we thought was gonna be sufficient for this. However, just before we went to construction, about 3 months before construction, something happened in the mine and our conditions changed. We went from having very low DO water that had lots of ferrous iron to oxidized water where we were getting ferric iron and our pHs were coming up. So I don't know if we had a roof fall or the water got rerouted or something happened. So in order for us to, you know, make this project work, we kind of had to change treatment technologies. We had originally discussed using an anoxic limestone drain, but then we decided to switch over to a vertical flow system. So what we did, we installed a primary settling pond, like I said, due to that varying pH, and it was all dependent on precipitation. We put in a large vertical flow reactor, and we also did a series of downstream wetlands. For those of you that don't know, a vertical flow reactor performs several functions. What you have is a bed of organic material, where the water comes in on the top, it flows down through the organic material, and I believe Jim's going to talk about this here in his next talk, where you get a couple things happening. One, you get any ferric iron that's oxidized will get reduced. You will see sulfate reduction as a result of the organisms in the organic substrate, and then you also get oxygen will get stripped. So what that does is that allows the limestone that's underneath the organic material to really treat the acid mine drainage in an oxidic condition, which prevents the precipitation of iron, but allows the treatment of the mine drainage. Just real quick note, this is the outfall structure for the vertical flow reactor. So the water comes in to the screen on my right, flows down through the system, and then these are essentially traps that discharge the water. What you see here is the outfall from that site. If you look upstream, you'll see there are several 3 or 4 wetland cells that basically are responsible for capturing those metals. After they come out, they reoxidize, and those metals that were in solution are now coming out of solution. So we've taken it, they have a pH of 4.8, now we're discharging it at a pH of 7.1. That 123 tons per year of acidity is now 96.9 tons per year of alkalinity, so it's a drastic change. We've eliminated almost all of the iron, and then we've eliminated almost all of the aluminum. This is our newest project. This is the Gwynn property. This one was just constructed or completed last fall. again, we're back to that alkaline environment where we just need to oxidize and give those metals time to settle out and precipitate. We have a pH of 6.7. Acidity was around 17.2 tons per year, with iron around 6.5 tons and aluminum at 0.35 tons. This project utilized a Bell siphon to perform periodic flushes. So the idea was that the portal, which you saw in the previous picture, would drain into this concrete box right here. It would reach a certain flow or it reach a certain level in that concrete box, and then it would discharge via bell siphon. So what that periodic flushing would allow us to, you know, kind of flush the water out of there, introduce a lot of oxygen from a result as it exited the discharge pipe from this, and, you know, kind of keep the wetlands. It would give them some additional retention time. Just a couple of notes on this project. This was the landowner was very adamant that we put this project in. He had been approached by several Marcellus drillers and wanted to be able to use the property to drill a well pad, basically down here in the bottom where you see the wetlands and that vehicle park right there. However, we had already entered into an agreement with them, which pretty much prevented the Marcellus folks from doing anything here. So that was a win for him. And plus, we're able to treat the Athamai Drainage. One additional note on this, the flushing bed actually goes, the pipes from the bell siphon actually flow down over this steep grade right here, and then it crosses underneath the creek and comes up in the other side in the wetlands. Excuse me. So, post-construction results, we took several samples in November, December. We're waiting on those samples to come back. The visual inspection of the outfall at where it discharges back into Lambert Run is very promising. We don't see any signs of aluminum or iron staining. Field pH is hovering around 7.3, 7.4. So it's going to be a really good project for us. So the results. We've been doing some biological studies on benthic macroinvertebrates. We did a study back in 2008 when a couple of these systems had already been installed. We came up, the WBSCI is the West Virginia Stream Condition Index. It's kind of a metric that tells you what kind of health your stream is in based on your benthic macroinvertebrates. We got a score of 26.2. This was done at several areas throughout the watershed. So it showed extremely poor conditions. Went back a year later after the one project had been put in on site 5, and we see where our score has jumped up to 57.8. We have some additional monies now to go back and do a third sampling later this year, probably March, hopefully, and we'll be able to really get an idea of what kind of impact from a biological standpoint these systems have had on the watershed. This picture was taken, if you look at the tributary to the left, this was the tributary that was coming down from Muzzleloader Club, our first project. This tributary was coming on the right, was coming from two of our sites, which was the Old Acre and the Site 9 project. This was pre-construction for those. This picture is now post-construction. Same area. This was the Muzzleloader tributary coming down, the Site 9 and the Old Acre and Site 9 tributary. You can see we've essentially eliminated all the iron. Benthic studies that we did in this area, we found some crane flies, we found a few mayflies, we found several other critters that are indicative of good water quality. So just some conclusions. We basically, with the five passive systems that we've installed in Lambert Run, we've neutralized 160 tons per year of acidity. Now we're dumping over 230 tons per year of alkalinity into Lambert, which in turn is making its way into the West Fork. It takes a group effort. You know, we had stakeholder group with the Guardians, state and federal agencies, West Virginia DEP, and the Office of Surface Mining. We also had some private health industry helping this project to supplement us whenever we had a few budgetary shortfalls. And the fact that passive treatment can really yield dramatic results in some of these smaller mining impacted watersheds. And with that, I'll take questions.
Great, thanks, Brady. We've got a number of questions that have come in while you were presenting, and I'm trying to call them together here. One question that several participants have been curious about is if there were any other metals in your discharges besides iron and aluminum, or if you tested for other metals.
We do have other metals in the effluent that comes out of these sources. But for in the state of West Virginia, we have our 303D list of impaired streams. And Lambert Run was listed for iron and acidity. So, you know, we had those other metals, and there are some reductions of those other metals due to the passive treatment, but our main focus was getting rid of the iron and the aluminum.
Okay, great. Another participant wants to know what is the range of flow being treated? And it follows up with, can you get some information on the size of the wetlands and if the iron accumulation requires removal from the wetlands?
Sure. The flows at the various sites range from, you know, a couple gallons a minute. Like our Site 8 project has about 4 gallons a minute at low flow, all the way up to 100, 150 gallons a minute. Our biggest flow that we treated to date goes back to Site 5, which was the alkaline discharge. Like I said, that was discharged at about 1,500 gallons a minute on average. And our Site 9 is around 400 or 450 gallons a minute. excuse me. So it's a range of flows that we're treating just because of these mines are shallow in nature and they're based on precipitation. So we do see a range in flows. The wetland size, we could throw that out there. Basically, what we would do is we would try to design these things knowing that we had enough oxygen introduced into them so that they would last and have like a 24-hour detention time based on average flow.
Okay, great. Another participant wants to know if you could talk a little bit about any permitting issues that you experienced associated with treating the water.
Sure. Like I said, the one project, the Site 8 project, the old Ackerman, we had issues with the Army Corps because they felt that we weren't doing enough in our treatment unit to be able to get sufficient credits. That was an alkaline source, but we were just removing the iron. Had it been an acidic source, you know, the kind of the precedent has been set that, boosting the pH, removing the metals is sufficient mitigation. But in that instance, we had to do some ag BMPs just to kind of satisfy their requirements. We deal with the Pittsburgh district here in north central West Virginia for our projects. It's kind of a challenge to get all of their requirements done and working with the budgets that we have to work with and get these things put in. But we usually get a DNR permit, which is like the public lands permit for doing stream work, the stream bed work. We have to go through there's SHPO permits involved. Part of the requirements for getting the OSM monies are doing the complete permitting process. That'd be SHPO, that would be environmental health and safety, I want to say, and there's one other one, I can't think of it, Michelle, it'll be off the top of my head.
It's okay. It'll come to you.
Hopefully.
You want to move on to maybe another question?
Sure.
We have a question about the muzzleloader and the Oldacre sites. Are they vegetated now, or have they been kept as open ponds? And I guess they want to know the same information for the Allen Meadows site.
Okay. The muzzleloader site is vegetated. Our first pond is heavily vegetated now. We've got lots of cattails, lots of bulrushes, lots of different wetland species in the wetland. One of the things that we learned when we went through these is that you really need to kind of keep your wetlands shallow in the beginning to get them for vegetation to take hold. One of the mistakes we made at muzzleloader was that our second polishing pond, we kind of put too much water in it too fast, and we're playing catch-up and trying to get our wetland species established. Our Old Acre site is vegetated. That picture is a couple years old now. If you go out to the site today, you'll see lots of cattails and rushes and things that have gotten established over time. Whenever you're planting these things, we typically plant them with a wetland species to try and get them established quicker, although it takes some time. These things just don't kind of pop up overnight. At least that's been our experience. And then the site 5, we do have vegetation growing now. It's not enough. We're going to probably go back this summer and try and reseed it and drop our water level down so we can continue to establish growth in there.
Great. I guess somewhat related, a participant wants to know about the maintenance requirements for the wetlands and settling ponds. Basically, they want to know if the sludge removal is required and how it's handled, disposed, and if there's any impacts to groundwater from the settling ponds.
Okay. We have not, to date, we have not done any kind of sludge removal from the wetlands. These wetlands were designed to last about 20 years, or to hold 20 years worth of sediment and of sludge. The thing that we've noticed is that as we get these accumulations of iron in these wetlands, they really are starting to settle and become compact and almost turn back into a soil. So looking at those results, we're kind of encouraged that we might not have to do any kind of sludge removal on these wetlands, at least not for the foreseeable future. Impacts to groundwater, we haven't really seen any, but we've not done a lot of groundwater monitoring either. Most of our monitoring is all surface flow, downstream and things, and we've only seen encouraging results as a result of these implementations.
Great. We have, you're just gained a lot of interest from this presentation. I can give you a couple more questions. I think we have a couple more minutes here if you're willing to answer a few more,
sure.
Brady.
Sure.
We have a participant who'd like to know what material you use to divide the cells.
Okay. We bought those. Those are vinyl seawalls that we bought from a place down in Georgia. And basically the reason we went with those was that they were chemically superior. They're UV resistant. They're unreactive to acidic or alkaline conditions. They're easy to install. And probably most importantly, they were cheap. The contractor had very little issue putting them in. They're durable. They don't fade with the sun. And they work really well when you've got, you know, equal forces on both sides, keeping those things supported.
Great. And how does the passive treatment systems work in flood conditions? How well do they work?
We've monitored during high flow events. We've seen a little bit of impact from a result of the water. A lot of times, though, it's not necessarily the precipitation event itself. It's the couple days afterwards when these mines get the rush of water once it makes its way into the mine. And what you see is just decreased detention time. So your pHs may fluctuate a little bit just depending on the mine. Sometimes you'll see a little bit of the flushing of the metals that'll make their way out of the well, and if we get a big flow of water that comes through. But being as that we're, all of these sites are pretty much up in the headwater reaches of Lambert Run, you don't have a whole lot of impact or influence from precipitation or these heavy rain events.
Okay, great. Maybe one more question. Can you provide me information on the cost to implement these systems?
Yeah. We had two sources of funding for this project. We had state funds that came from DEP, which were passed through from EPA, and then we also had off-surface mining funds, which were federal funds. Those funds got matched together. For these five projects, we've spent probably, off the top of my head, we're about $1.7 million so far. And that's everything. That's construction, that's administration, that's sampling, the monitoring. Site 9 was about $500,000 for construction. Site 5, Site 8, and Site the muzzleloader were all around $180,000 to $200,000 construction, and then Site 5 I think was around $220,000. So we've got about $1.7 or so by the time it's all said and done.
Okay, great. Thanks, Brady. Your presentation definitely sparked a lively discussion. We have a few more questions that have come in, and if there's time at the end of the next two presenters' presentations, then maybe we can come back to you and pose those to you again. But thank you. I think that was very interesting and very informative.
Great.
So now we're ready to move into our next presenter, who's Jim Gussick from Golder Associates. I think Jean will be moving up your presentation in a moment. Looks like she's getting setting it up there now. We'll have to get you to the first slide of your presentation.
There goes my big surprise at the end. Damn.
Don't look, everybody, don't look.
Okay,
so we're at the beginning of your presentation now. Just to give an introduction, Jim has 30 years professional career as a mining engineer, at which time he's acquired a wide range of experience in mining-related projects, including experience with a number of challenging mine land reclamation projects such as geotechnical investigations, development of grading and reclamation plans, and the design of constructed wetlands for treating polluted mine water. Jim, we're very excited to see your presentation, and it's your turn now.
Fantastic. Thank you, Michelle. I first presented this talk at EPA's 2008 Remediation of Abandoned Mine Lands Conference in Denver, and I've tried to keep it up to date since then, but since we only have about 25 minutes, these are some of the key points that we're going to try and hit. I'm going to talk about, I've got a pointer. We're going to talk about the chemistry and microbiology, give a few examples of passive treatment components, which you've already seen in Brady's talk, talk a little bit more about the design process, maybe do some descriptions of three case studies, and talk about the key treatment issues. So moving on, I'd like to acknowledge, you know, usually you, as a professional courtesy, you acknowledge your co-authors, but in this case, I'd like to post for the record, some 40 people involved in the pioneering of passive treatment since the mid-1980s. If you Google any of these names, you'll likely find a bunch of published information. And my apologies for anybody who's missing. I kind of ran out of space. I didn't want the font to get too small. And there are also some additional names interspersed throughout the talk. At this point, you know, for centuries, miners have been relying on Mother Nature to remediate mining-influenced water. And as we've discovered, there's more to it than simple dilution. Nowadays, you've got three options, and Brady talked about a few of these. First one is active treatment, basically treatment by brute force using chemicals and energy. And then we also have passive treatment, which kind of relies on Mother Nature and, you know, all the wonderful things that can happen Mother Nature's been doing just fine for all these years. And then lastly, and we don't talk about this very often, but there's also the opportunity to maybe do passive and active treatment systems, kind of like hybrids. But as Brady did, we're just going to focus today on passive treatment. So what is passive treatment? Is it a black box? What's going on here? Basically, here's the first pass at defining the concept. And I'm a little colorblind, but my marketing folks tell me there's a subliminal message buried in this slide someplace. I hope you can find it. First of all, passive treatment is a sequential technology because one process typically won't be enough to produce acceptable water quality. You'll have a series of different processes that combine to do what you need to do. Secondly, it's an ecological process, probably because there's a microbe or a plant that's typically involved in the treatment. And lastly, it's an extraction process, because even if you can convert a soluble parameter into an insoluble particle, it still has to be physically filtered out to avoid discharging the contaminant as, a part of your total suspended solid. So we'd like to do all these things, and we'd also like to have it blend into the landscape if we can. So moving on, there's, taking the definition to the kind of the boilerplate version. So passive treatment systems are used processes that are common geochemical reactions, assisted by plants or bugs. We don't require any additional chemical reagents, power, or short-term exchange of media. And lastly, we'd like to have these things function for long periods. Brady mentioned 20 years. I agree with that. At least, a couple of decades before you have to do any type of major maintenance. They're low maintenance, but let me say, they are not no maintenance. So ideally, what we'd love to have would be this ideal situation. Here is a volunteer passive treatment system which established itself at a portal of a collapsed tunnel in Colorado. Nobody built this. This system has been apparently functioning without any human intervention for over 100 years. This is kind of, for us engineer types, this is the holy grail. We'd love to be able to have this as a walk-away situation. And generally speaking, I think we're getting there, but we're not there quite yet. But let's start looking at the first principles of passive treatment and review how these passive treatments really work. And one thing we want to say here is that the sulfate and carbonate precipitation is a major removal mechanism, and we're using bacteria. And these are typically desulfibrio, sulfur-reducing bacteria. In the hydroxide and oxide precipitation, we use thiobacillus ferrooxidans, maybe some other types. But one of the things that we do have to rely on is some abiotic reactions. As Brady talked about, we also worry about, we use carbonate dissolution and replacement. It uses a lot of open limestone channels, anoxic limestone drains, things like that to help. And also we're talking about filtering and of the suspended materials and precipitates. Again, this extraction process that I referred to a couple slides ago. So we've known for quite a while that metal uptake into plants and in the plant parts and absorption and exchange are relatively minor removal mechanisms. But lately, we are seeing more and more importance being placed on adsorption onto soil and other biological materials. And we're starting to recognize this importance and starting to become part of our design process. Sorry, we're going to have to talk about some chemistry. So to refresh your memory, the basic chemistry of passive treatment is pretty well understood. And these are reactions that are typically found in various parts of a passive treatment system. I'm going to jump down here to iron the hydrolyzation of iron. So we've got iron plus 3, ferric iron, hydrolyzing. The yellow boy, this is the all that yellow staining that you saw in a lot of in Brady's slides. One of the biggest problems with this reaction is the production of hydrogen ions. So when this process goes to, or this reaction goes to completion, what's going to happen? Your pH is going to drop like a rock. So what you need now is to have a little bit of calcium carbonate. In the case of limestone dissolution, you're producing the bicarbonate ion. So this is kind of Tums, you know, or like Tums for acid rock drainage, and be able to neutralize a lot of this acidity with bicarbonate alkalinity. So as we jump to the top of the screen here, these two equations are probably what have made what I've followed in my career is the sulfate reduction using bacteria, desulfibrio. We take sulfate, an organic source. We're producing sulfide ion, bicarbonate ion. So this process or this equation can actually raise the pH of your mine drainage. And we take the sulfide ion, and in this case, we're combining it with zinc, divalent zinc, and we're precipitating the mineral zinc sulfide or sphalerite. And so this is kind of the Rosetta Stone of most of the passive treatment reactions that are occurring in a lot of our systems. But we'd also like to look at a couple of few selected uncommon parameters and see what mechanisms we can also use on these. And one of them is aluminum. And it's a big problem in a lot of coal mine drainage because of the formation of gibbsite, which is really a sludgy material. And this happens anytime you raise the pH of above 4.5. It causes this gelatinous aluminum hydroxide and causes a lot of plugging. And in biochemical reactors, VCRs, we tend to form an aluminum hydroxysulfate precipitation. Here are two examples, alunite and ettringite. And these mineral phases here do not cause as much plugging. This is first documented by a researcher, B.T. Thomas, over a decade ago, that this is a process that was actually forming. What about arsenic removal? This is another special case. This lower reaction here, we have sorption onto ferric oxyhydroxide. This is probably the dominant one in most passive treatment systems, and one would expect it to be abiotic. But actually, what's really happening is that we see LeBlanc et al. In 1996 documented that there were some bacteria that were actually using an arsenic as part of the bacterial sheath and forming this this coating at a mine site in France. This is, again, published in 1996. Now, this sounds to me like a great field trip, and so we really should figure out what's going on here, and if there's anyone out in the audience who has a specific budget for doing this, please send me a message. Be sure to follow up on that. Also, zero valent iron can be used to remove arsenic. There's a lot of evidence in the literature that this is happening. We also see it happening in the laboratory. We can absorb arsenic onto iron oxide hydroxide media that's commercially available. We've documented this pretty well in the laboratory. Now, selenium is another parameter that's been receiving a lot of attention lately, especially in the coal mines in Canada. And we've been designing a lot of biochemical reactors that produce elemental selenium, but I'm not convinced that this is the only mechanism that's going on here based on the geological evidence. But so far, no one seems to mind if the selenium is coming out in some of these instances, getting to below the 5 ppb limits. Manganese is another special case. We've seen more and more concern about manganese removal in some of our mining influenced water situations. Fortunately, this is an aerobic reaction that's facilitated by algae, moss, and associated specialized bacteria that precipitate the mineral pyrolusite, which is manganese dioxide. This slide shows one situation at the Pinal Creek site in Arizona where a local alluvium has been cemented together by manganese oxide to actually form manganocrete. This is amazing stuff. I've seen it elsewhere at some other sites in Arizona. And Nori Robbins of the USGS identified a dozen ways that microbes can facilitate this. I think you can download her papers off the internet pretty easily. So how do these bugs do it? What's going on? Believe it or not, the algae produce manganese dioxide barnacles that allow them to attach themselves to rocks and just about anything else in the water. And the cool thing about it is this is a very good thing. It's the best. These barnacles remain after the algae dies, and they provide adsorption sites. This mechanism is responsible for the black staining in many stream beds downstream from mining districts. So when you're out in the field, you might look for this black staining, and you can see by an inspection that it's probably manganese oxide. So when we start to take a closer look at this phenomenon, we actually see, or it's my opinion, that manganese oxide is kind of Mother Nature's activated carbon, because not only will it adsorb just about everything else in the periodic table, but it also adsorbs onto itself. This slide shows a situation at the abandoned Atlantic City iron mine in Wyoming, where some dry weight moss at this natural seat alongside of an abutment in one of the tailings dams was actually assayed and contained as much as, it contained 39% manganese and 13% zinc by dry weight. And so when you start looking at what's going on here, as you see, the orange dots are actually iron oxidizing bacteria that are latched onto this moss, and the black dots are manganese oxidizing bacteria, and these black dots is actually manganese dioxide, and that's where the zinc is being sequestered. So it's happening all around us, and Sometimes it takes a microscope to see what's going on. So from a constructed wetland or a passive treatment perspective, what we're really trying to do is mimic Mother Nature. And so what's happening with in say, a typical wetland ecosystem, natural system, we see two primary reaction zones. We see an aerobic zone at the surface that's fully oxygenated, and then we see deeper below an anaerobic zone. And in Mother Nature, these zones are in competition with each other as the water levels rise and fall. And so theoretically and practically, we do see mobilization of some metals that are, say, dropped out in the aerobic zone. If that zone turns anaerobic, it can actually release these metals and vice versa. Anaerobic zones turning oxic will also release metals. So this is not a good thing. So this photo on the side here shows what these processes look like in the field. They're processes in competition. We've got orange oxidizing conditions that are near the surface, positive oxidation reduction potentials. This is facilitated by plants, and the anoxic muck that's found below the surface. So in designing passive treatment components, what we try to do is emphasize one of these conditions over the other. And so we try to make it a particular cell predominantly oxidizing or predominantly reducing. I think Brady mentioned this earlier, that you actually see you want to design passive treatment systems with very little or shallow systems. So design engineers typically apply these biochemical principles in actual situations by deploying one or more of the above components in series. So for convenience, these are shown divided into limestone components on the left, on the right, and biological components. And so Brady spent a lot of time on the limestone, so I'm not going to. And what is going to be appropriate for individual mine water chemistries is going to help us decide, you know, which of these processes are going to work. So we start to look at maybe a decision tree in terms of deciding which ones of these are the most important. Now, this passive treatment component selection tree was originally developed for coal-derived mining-influenced water, and Brady's project engineers probably followed this in their design process. It's been around in some form for about 20 years, and a lot of the new technologies might not even be recommended. Back in 1994, BCRs were recognized as compost wetlands because they use mushroom compost for the material in construction. Again, these were mostly focused on iron, aluminum, and acidity. So fast forward 20 years, and this is what the decision tree looks like now. And in a typical, this is what it looks like now. We typically design our systems, include a biochemical reactor, aerobic wetland, maybe a mixing pond, settling pond. I don't have enough time to spend a lot on this, but what happens when you start looking at more complex geochemistry? You know, like if you have parameters like uranium, zinc, arsenic, and maybe even toss a little bit of thallium. How do you deal with this in this decision tree? What we've tried to do in terms of addressing this is taking a closer look at the periodic table and trying to assign various processes to the various components. So for the legend here, we've got blue elements are mostly appropriate for biochemical reactors. Orange elements are associated, say, with aerobic reactions. If you've got both colors in the same element, you could do it either way. And this has been used in the most case in terms of helping us to understand, you know, what are our options in moving forward in some of our designs. But the one thing that's not covered in this, remember I mentioned manganese a few minutes ago? Information in the public literature suggests that all of these metals will absorb to manganese oxide coating. So this is an emerging facet of passive treatment. You're hearing it here first, folks. The key design feature is for manganese removal is that iron needs to be precipitated first before you see your pyrolusite or your other manganese oxide coatings to occur. So what's it take the information from these two last two remember this one, passive treatment 101? So in essence, what we've seen is we've applied the color code, the blue color code, for all of those processes that produce reducing anaerobic conditions, and we use the oxidizing conditions with the orange, and develop kind of a whole suite we're going to be looking at some photos of these two processes, and so you can tell just by color code what's going on. So what's moving on, I think that we see settling and surge ponds are necessary part of the process. It's an important, especially if solids could clog up some of the other passive treatment processes that rely on flow through porous media in order to work. We can also use these ponds to moderate peaks and unsteady flow rate. So these ponds are typically fully oxidized. Maybe in the deeper parts you might see some reducing conditions, but generally they're designed to be oxidizing. So what about biochemical reactors? BCRs have had many names since they've evolved from research work almost 30 years ago. And these may look like deep ponds that you see at a golf course, but in reality, the water depth is only a few inches or a few centimeters. You can actually walk across these things without getting your knees wet. And these components work great for aluminum, heavy metals, aluminum, heavy metals, denitrification. We can actually add them, use them for alkalinity addition. This is the vertical flow pond that, that Brady was talking about. So these are pretty robust or pretty flexible systems. And when we start looking at the design, is pretty simple. It's almost like making coffee on a large scale. In this case, the bioreactions in the organic and the limestone substrate remove heavy metals rather than adding mocha. And to function properly, the substrate needs to be constantly submerged. While this slide shows a downflow cell, we've also considered designing these cells so that they're upflow as well. But this is typically not applicable for very aggressive mine water chemistry. You'll note that that plants aren't required for a BCR. All the organic matter provides the material, the nutrients that our desulfibrio bacteria need. But what's also interesting is if you don't need plants, you can actually bury these systems underground or even install them into underground mines. And so when we start looking at construction, it's fairly simple. Mixing the mixed organic substrate can basically be placed using a variety of methods as long as the liner of the cell is protected. Also, if you need to add, if you need to bury the cells and leave a gap above the top of the substrate, you can use these off-the-shelf septic system liners or septic system components as shown here. Again, all of these, what we've been talking about so far, are anaerobic reducing condition type of reactors. So where do we get our bugs? Where do we get our bacteria? And it's closer than you think. The local dairy farm or even bags of composted steer manure from the local gardening center have the bugs that we need for this for these types of cells. So, okay, I know I won't hear you laughing around, but around the office, I'm known as the manure connoisseur or the poo-poo guru, the king of crap. You could say I know my stuff. But other researchers have revealed more about the microbial communities in BCRs than I could ever imagine. When we first started the design process, we thought that the sulfate-reducing bacteria, the desulfibrio down here, were all important. Turns out that they're less than 1% of the total bug community. What we really needed to be concerned about was all the other cellulitic bacteria. This work was done by microbiologists at the Colorado State University and Colorado School of Mines, and they confirmed our suspicions that a consortium of bugs are really required to make these systems work. So, but can find these cellulose degraders, fermenters, various methanogens, and so forth that are all helping to break down the organic matter. Fortunately, we can find these whole suites of bacteria, like I said, in bags of compost and steer manure, as well as fresh poop from the source. You go to, say, a mixed source, you could say you've got a poopery of microbial community available to you. So we think we talked about the anaerobic processes enough. Time to move on. Aerobic cells, shown here, are typically dominated by oxidizing reactions. Again, these are facilitated by various microbial communities. And these look like typical cattail and willow-dominated wetlands. And they're great, as Brady has talked about, for removing iron. And in our case, we use it a lot for removing arsenic. We also use it to remove biochemical oxygen demand. As the water comes out of some of these biochemical reactors, it's virtually anoxic and has a little bit of excess BOD. These systems, aerobic cells, can also be used for manganese removal and, again, as I said before, removing other heavy metals as well. Iron terraces are a special case of aerobic cells. You'll note that the apparent absence of plants here, but don't be fooled. A closer look would reveal that there's lots of organic matter from the leaves and the twigs from the nearby trees and bushes can provide this organic matter, or on the surface of this this iron terrace, we actually see some photosynthetic algae blooms that can also provide a source of carbon. So if there's any arsenic present in these waters, it would be certainly be absorbed onto these iron precipitates. So now as we start getting into the design, for as much progress as we made since 1985, you'd think we'd have a cookbook by now. So what we do know is that the geochemistry of the mine water will control the cell type and that the dimensions are controlled somewhat by the metal loading, which is a function of flow times concentration. To eliminate a lot of the uncertainty, we've come to embrace kind of a standard testing protocol that involves lab tests, bench and pilot scale testing to minimize the risk of failure. And most of these tests involve either oxidizing or reducing processes that are found in typical wetland ecosystems. And these tests are designed to mimic the larger scale cells in full-scale treatment systems. So in the meantime, what you can do, there's a lot of information available that I don't have enough time to go into it in depth. I would also recommend this book from the Society of Mining Engineers as a co-author, co-editor on this. You also can check out the GARD Guide and download a lot of this information for free, or try Googling the names of those folks on slide number 2 as we are starting out. So to eliminate a lot of the design uncertainty, we've come to embrace this standard testing and design protocol. We rarely do proof of principle tests. Most of the time now we conduct bench scale tests to select, say, the best recipes, and we move up to pilot scale and then full scale tests. And all of these are usually combined to allow us to do our homework very effectively and very inexpensively. So you can test a lot of BCR recipe combinations in the lab with these static tests that can be conducted over about the space of 2 months. But don't forget the control bottles. Verify what's going on without any substrate. Also, bench scale tests typically run from 12 to 16 weeks and are, in essence, a cook-off of the best bet, similar best bet substrate recipes, say, from the proof of principle testing. Here we eliminate the obvious losers with poor metal removal performance and select a final design recipe based on media longevity and cost from amongst the winners. This gives you an example of some of the bench scale tests, and a lot of these are designed to function without power out in the field. So we might use the best recipe from the bench test to design a pilot scale bioreactor. So we try to keep it as low tech as possible and keep the cost down. This cell up in this BCR cell up in Wyoming used a Sears swimming pool that cost about $600. It was on sale at the end of the season. mistreated water from a copper mine at elevation of about 9,500 feet or 3,000 meters for about 2 years before it was intentionally decommissioned. Gave us a lot of good design data. So now I'm going to talk about
Jim, just to jump in, Jim, this is Michelle. I just want to check in with you and let you know we have about 5 minutes left for your presentation.
Okay. Yep, thank you. We're moving as fast as we can. Okay, so I'm going to talk about three quick case studies. Basically, a BCR system in Missouri. This has been functioning for past 16 years, and it wasn't that bad of water. The cost of this, I heard some people talking about the costing question. This is treated 10.4 billion gallons at a cost of about 6.5 cents per 1,000 gallons. Another example is the Glinsky mine in California, where the influent water here is a net pH of pH of 3 with lots of acidities. Effluent worked out really well. We ran this for about 27 months. Used this to design a full-scale system. The design was a little bit difficult to implement. We had to move everything across the lake in a World War II landing craft. We used stimulus funding in 2010 to build the large-scale system. Has a capacity of 10 gallons per minute. Cost 1.3 million gallons to construct, and which over a 20-year life would cost about a penny per gallon of operating of cost. For startup in 2010, pretty much mimicked the pilot scale system. We're seeing a lot of good reduction of metals and increase in pH, also good reduction in sulfate from 340 milligrams per liter down to 100, part of the design. This is what the site looked like in startup in 2013, and you can also see this site in Google Earth if you're interested. The last example here is the Arizona copper mine. Here we did some the design was for 15 gallons per minute, total construction cost of about $1.6 million. Dollars. It was built in 2009. It's working fine right now. As a matter of fact, here's the aerobic polishing cell downstream from the BCR, and the site now is just lush. The Arizona system a year after operation showed just remarkable improvements in terms of sulfate reduction, zinc reduction, and so forth. We actually we've seen also improvements in the influent water as well. So when we finally come down to it, the key treatment issues are on this slide. Do you have the land surface available? How long do you want things to last? Typically, we're designing for 20 years. Whether we have to, how you dispose of residuals. And I think the key point that I'd like people to take home is that from a cost perspective, you have to compare it to active treatment. And typically, what we've seen is the net present value numbers are about 50% less. But one of the things is, if you want to implement this next week, that's not going to happen. You really need to start looking at doing all your homework in advance in terms of design and minimizing the risk. So we've come a long way since 1985. We've got an established design protocol, bench and laboratory and pilot studies. We've treated a wide range of operating conditions. And I think what's most important is absorption of manganese dioxide in neutral pH is starting to gain ground. So keep your eyes on that. I think that from a perspective of excuse me a hitch here. I think a lot of these advantages have been self-evident. One thing I didn't discuss at length was the resource recovery in the future and putting some of these materials to beneficial use. There's already a company near Pittsburgh that harvests iron oxyhydroxide from coal mine passive treatment systems and sells it as paint pigment. So there's a number of technical issues that have addressed this this concept. And in summary, I think that these are the take-home messages I hope I shared with you all in the past few minutes. Passive treatment can be very cost-effective compared to the alternative technologies. We can address a lot of different variety of flows, chemistry, and site conditions. And longevity is typically on the order of decades. And this design process is pretty well established in the and seems to be working pretty well. And with that, I think I know you've seen this already, but thank you so much for your attention. I think we've got time for questions.
Yes, thank you, Jim.
Did I finish on time?
Excuse me?
Did I finish on time?
You did great. I think we have time now for a couple more questions for you. So we've got quite a few that's come in while you were presenting. Again, stimulated a lot of conversation here in our Adobe Connect room. One participant wants to know if you can explain the temperature dependence on the operation of these aerobic and anaerobic cells.
Okay. Well, from an aerobic perspective, we have seen these, iron oxidation and manganese oxidation occur virtually in all climates. I've been in the Leadville tunnel drainage at altitude 10,000 feet in the middle of winter. I've seen algae growth and manganese oxide precipitation. So from an aerobic perspective, as long as the water is flowing, you probably don't have any issues. Now, for biochemical reactors, it's a slightly different story because the oxidation or the use of or the degradation of the organic matter will slow down significantly at low temperatures. But we've seen reasonable sulfate reduction rates at temperatures a hair's breadth above freezing. Typical design number might be 0.3 moles of sulfate reduction per day per cubic meter of substrate at ambient temperature. Down around freezing, it might be, say, 85% of that value. The key there is to get the system started and commissioned in warm weather so that as the cold weather, the cold water conditions set in, that that your microbial population has had a chance to mature.
Great. It looks like someone typed something in related to that last question. Let me open this up. This first person wants to know if passive treatment is adequate for decades and AMD goes on for hundreds to thousands of years. Is this feasible in the long run? I guess they want to know if passive treatment is a feasible solution.
Well, it depends on what you're trying to accomplish. Again, passive treatment, if ARD goes on forever, there are some, I've seen out in the field, say, evidence that some passive treatment systems have volunteer systems, Mother Nature-derived systems, have been functioning literally for hundreds and thousands of years without human intervention. So if you have enough land area available, and you have, I would say the answer is yes, you can build these systems for long term, especially if you're using them, taking the materials that they're producing and putting them to beneficial use. I think that it beats the alternative of Lyme dosing and active treatment. And I'm sure Brady and Kevin would agree with me.
Great. I just want to let you know you've gotten several comments about what an excellent presentation, and everyone is really happy to have participated and heard your information. I think we can take one more question while we pull up Kevin Mayer's presentation and move him into the presenter. This person wants to know if you can elaborate on the advantages of downflow versus upflow sulfate-reducing bacteria reactors.
Okay, it depends. It depends on the chemistry of the water that you're trying to treat in your biochemical reactor. If you have, say, a very very low pH water, highly acidic water that contains a lot of, say, elevated amounts of aluminum and or iron. Doing an upflow bioreactor, in my experience, is going to cause you nothing but headaches, because as soon as that water comes up underneath, it's going to drop out the iron, it's going to drop out the aluminum, and it's going to plug up in a heartbeat. If I have, say, those parameters, high iron, high aluminum, a downflow cell is almost, it's dictated. And the reason for that is these materials will drop out on the surface, and within the reaction zone, as the water flows down, you will see less and less plugging because you've got these other reactions occurring. You've got you're forming the aluminum hydroxy sulfates that I referred to in one of my slides, which don't cause plugging problems. Let me say that the highest amount of aluminum that I've ever treated in a BCR downflow is almost 250 milligrams per liter. And this is a site in Pennsylvania. And I think Brady would agree that if you've got that amount of aluminum, it's enough to choke any limestone-based system in weeks. So okay. But if to answer the other question, if you have net alkaline water that has, you know, just some, say, copper, lead, zinc, cadmium, mercury, an upflow system might work just fine. Because the West Fork system in Missouri was plumbed both ways.
Great. Okay. Well, thanks again, Jim. I think we're going to move on to our last presenter, Kevin Mayer. And Kevin, I've given you presenter rights. And then make sure that you have muted your speakers on your computer if you're streaming the audio from Adobe Connect, so we just hear you through the phone. To introduce Kevin, he works for the U.S. EPA in the Pacific Southwest region in Region 9 in the Superfund program. And since 1990, Kevin has managed Superfund's cleanup projects, including a number of very large groundwater contamination sites in California. When Leviathan Mine became a federal Superfund site in 2000, he became EPA's project manager in addition to overseeing other Superfund projects. So as you can see, Kevin is going to speak to us about the Leviathan Mine. So, Kevin, go ahead.
Yes, hello. Is the audio okay then, Jean? Michelle?
Yep, you're fine.
All right, thanks. Gary Riley and I, project managers, put this presentation together over the last few months. But recently, I'm transitioning off, and Lily and John will be taking over the project on my behalf. So those names that you see as project managers, any one of us can be happy to talk to you if you have questions in the future. So let's see. Are we supposed to move it? Can they?
If there's some arrows in the bottom left-hand corner that you can advance the slides. If you prefer, I could move them for you. Looks like you got
it. I found it. Thank you.
Okay, great.
So Leviathan Mine is actually an abandoned open pit sulfur mine high in the Sierra Nevada, not too far, about 25 miles from Lake Tahoe, that notch in California, or the convex notch in Nevada. So it actually, although it's in California, the flows are downhill toward the north into Nevada. So we've got multiple numbers of interested parties, because not only does the waste from the mine flow through U.S. forest, national forest, on its way to Nevada, it flows through tribal land and into Nevada through some private land, ultimately into a major water course, the Carson River, which is in the dry lands of Nevada, very important in western Nevada. quickly the history, the main part that really is driving this issue is that Anaconda developed this geothermal vent with elemental sulfur, with massive amounts of elemental sulfur, back in the early 1950s in order to provide a source ultimately for sulfuric acid for a different copper mine in Nevada. Shortly after the mine was opened, fish kills were noted throughout the 9 miles of the watershed, even some potentially into the Carson River itself, 9 miles away. The state of California, through their Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board, tried to respond to the issues in the 1980s. In the year 2000, it became a federal Superfund site, and we're working with responsible parties to implement additional cleanup projects besides the relatively passive work that the Regional Water Quality Control Board did. So this shows 1950s. You can see near the bottom some of the trucks as the open pit was being mined. There was a massive amount of overburden over the top of the sulfur ore that was pushed off to one side into an adjacent sub-watershed. And then any of the ore that was less than 20% sulfur was basically discarded into the Leviathan Creek watershed. So this mine operated for about a decade before it was abandoned. And here on the Leviathan Creek watershed side, you can see the waste piles of the sulfur mining material that didn't meet that 20% cutoff as Leviathan Creek is flowing through it. This is actually during a particularly high flow period. Since we're on the east side of the Sierra Nevada, this is the dry side, and the high flows happen basically as the snow is melting in the early part of the spring, or late part of the spring, early part of the summer. So you can see from this how much material is carried downstream. Also, though, acidic water was formed. So about 3 miles downstream, even in the late 1990s, you can see the right side is Leviathan Creek, another tributary that's not impacted by the mine. Mountaineer Creek is coming in from the left side. So it's quite some contrast. The water in Leviathan Creek at this point is still fairly acidic, still in the 3-4 pH range. 6 miles downstream, you can still see a lot of that precipitate. No questions why they call it Yellow Boy, the iron and aluminum oxide, oxyhydroxides coming out in precipitation. Still fairly acidic, and this is 9 miles downstream where the creek system affected by Leviathan Mine is blending with the Carson River. Some of the sediment on the bottom of the creek. So what we have at Leviathan is about 250 acres, 50 acres of the open pit, and then a couple of hundred acres of waste rock, various amounts of sulfur or sulfide that essentially form a big tea bag where oxygen and water flow through and sulfuric acid with all the dissolved minerals, not only massive amounts of iron and aluminum, but also arsenic, copper, nickel, zinc, cadmium, so on and so forth. These red lines, red arrows, show where the acid seeps are daylighting. So I call them identified contaminant sources, they're actually where the acidic water is coming out of various seeps or, in one case, an attic. So let me talk about what the state of California tried doing in 1985. They tried going almost entirely passive, using the warm, dry summers to evaporate the volume of liquid. They covered about 12 or more acres with about 15 to 17 million gallon capacity ponds that were specifically designed to capture two of the highest acidity sources via gravity and then evaporate them. They also tried to minimize the generation of mine influenced water by channelizing Leviathan Creek with a concrete channel and routing, terracing and routing stormwater and snowmelt directly into the creek to minimize the amount of infiltration, percolation, and as I said, that teabag effect of generating sulfuric acid. So prior to the state's operation, you see on the left Leviathan Creek going through the large acreage of waste rock. So they essentially put that into concrete channels to separate it from the chemically active waste material. And then on the right, there's a collapsed mine. And coming out of the portal or the adit of that mine was remarkably acidic, very, I heard the word aggressive in Jim's talk, very low pH, high acidity water. And this was considered, and still is considered, some of the most important material to try to get a hand on it and keep from getting into the ecosystem. So here you see what they did. They terraced the open pit, which is in the lower part of this picture, created these evaporation ponds, and diverted the stream through a concrete channel that runs in the upper quarter, basically goes from left to right, which also happens to be from fairly high elevation to several hundred feet lower elevation. And this is another shot of that from the upper wall of the open pit, showing the surrounding watershed, some of the surrounding watershed. So in the evaporation pond that was constructed to capture, primarily to capture the adit seep, you can see this very colorful iron oxidation, very low pH, very high acidity, takes a lot to neutralize this particular water. So the large arrow, we'll talk about when these ponds turned out not to be completely adequate to contain and evaporate the material. In fact, after a few years, once you get wet years, you get the ponds overflowing into the creek, not only with the adit water, but with highly concentrated adit water through the evapoconcentration of this material. So the Lahontan Region Water Quality Control Board is operating a lime treatment system, not a passive system, but they operate it only during the summer months, which are only about, at this high of an elevation in the mountains, really getting in there much before June is really pushing it. And you pretty much need to start wrapping things up by the end of September. Blizzards happen that early. So essentially they do a lime treatment system, pumping the water out of the ponds, mixing it with lime in a couple of stages, and then that lime acidic material slurry is piped uphill slightly into the open pit where they constructed a settling basin, what we call the pit clarifier, where some of the chemistry continues to, some of the reactions continue to happen. The precipitate settles out, and the clean water goes both overflow and underflow through a sand bed filter. It's tested and discharged. The ponds actually capture the flows from the attic, and they construct an underdrain source when they filled in the pit, or partially filled in the pit. They put French drains to keep some of the water from percolating even deeper into the sulfur material. And then they, in the summer, all the water that's been captured in the ponds is treated versus lime neutralization. If necessary, the ponds are threatening to overflow like they are in particularly wet years, they have been able to mobilize a mobile lime treatment system and operate that. The annual cost was less than $1 million for the plant, and somewhat less than that, again, depending on the amount of flows. There is year-to-year wide differences in the amount of acidity produced at Leviathan Mine. So in 2011, the 2010-2011 year was very wet, so that we had to treat nearly 18-19 million gallons just from these two sources, whereas in 2012, it was less than 3 million gallons. We do have issues with the, although the pit clarifier is relatively simple to operate, very little energy involved, we still generate about 1,000 tons of solids that are fairly dry, whether it's a wet year or a dry year. Adding, let's see, what did we add? About 62 tons of lime and a fair amount of energy. A few thousand gallons of diesel needs to be used to operate just that treatment system. So we'll go to another treatment system, which is also active, that captures what we call the channel underdrain, which is a series of seeps that were formed through the waste rock material, and the delta seep, which is the topological or topographic low point of the Leviathan Creek side. So delta seep and channel underdrain are only captured in the spring to the fall. They have to be pumped uphill several hundred feet to an equalization pond and treated via a high-density sludge system, which is a high-tech way of lime neutralization. So this shows the delta seep. You can see one of our colleagues up a couple of about 150 feet up at the top of the, near the top of one of the waste piles. We really don't have much room to operate there to capture. The channel underdrain drains underneath the concrete channel. That is captured. That still also has to be pumped uphill, but rather than a couple of hundred feet, we're looking at just tens of feet. You'd see the equalization pond and then the high-density sludge system, which has been operated there since 2009. It uses quite a bit of energy, but generates much less treatment sludge, although you must remember this is not as acidic water as the material coming out of the attic. Treatment costs are higher, uses considerably more energy, maybe 15,000 gallons of diesel. Construction and operation of this system is quite high. And frankly, operators can only get up there about 6 months of the year if they're lucky. For the rest of the year, this water is allowed to discharge
untreated until we get to a long-term treatment system. I want to switch over to the Aspen seep, which collects water from the overburden, which is a lot less acidic water, much less acidic water. Here you see aspen seep coming out of the toe of 150 acres of waste rock, mostly that overburden. So sulfides and some just pure sulfate. We went through at least six generations. We had the good fortune of having researchers from the University of Nevada come up here and try various manure composters, initial attempts of working at the channel under drain, plugged up very rapidly. So they switched over to the attic area where the acidity is much less. However, that still also plugged up. Then they tried using a rock substrate as an attachment for the sulfate-reducing bacteria, and then adding, instead of relying on the cellulosic material in the manure and the wood chips, they would just add a liquid. In this case, they're adding ethanol, which is not strictly fully passive, but is relatively passive. We're letting the biological activity happen. And it worked, but it wasn't designed all that well. So in 2000, we designed a rock bioreactor that actually is working year-round with ethanol feed, using a lot less energy, generating much less sludge than either of the others. It's primarily iron sulfide, but it's precipitating out the arsenic and other metals as well. Handling the sludge is a burden. We've gone to a recirculation mode so that we separate the precipitation of the solids, mostly from the biological treatment of the sulfate. If you want more information on this compost-free bioreactor, the Superfund Innovative Technology Program published a very thorough evaluation report back in March 2006, and that's available through EPA. So we have very different waters. No treatment system actually works perfectly for all the waters. We're attempting a spectrum from fairly passive to very active. Obviously preventing as much as possible the generation of the acid rock drainage is preferable. We have to consider construction cost and the relative operation and maintenance cost. We're still in an early action. We have not selected a final remedy for the Superfund, but we're gaining a lot of experience with these various essentially full-scale early response actions. Results have been really pretty remarkable. The lower 6 miles of what had been a severely impaired stream are showing quite good results through multiple lines of evidence. We've got trout surviving there. We're actually doing toxicity test results, trout and daphnia, plus the native macroinvertebrates are really coming back very well. In the upper 3 miles of the stream, we're getting some positive results, but especially within the last mile, we've got a lot more to do. Unfortunately, the beavers really like that part, and we think they're changing a lot of the water chemistry by their beaver ponds on top of some precipitate and acid material. So just some happy pictures a few miles downstream showing clean water. And essentially, we've got serious problems with site access, bringing personnel, power sources, raw material sources up a narrow, very steep mine road that is essentially inaccessible for about 6 months of the year, and then we also have to pull the residual material, most of it, down that mountain. Anyway, that's the last bit of my presentation. I'll turn it over to our facilitators.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. We have a few questions that have come in while you were speaking, and I just want to let the three of you presenters know that we are continually getting wonderful praise about this webinar, and I'm really glad that you all could take the time and come and speak together, because we're getting a lot of positive response, and I think it's I think we'll get a lot of hits on the archive too. So we have a questioner who was curious about which high density sludge treatment system you used.
It's a system that was designed by a successor to Anaconda Copper. And they basically use energy to keep the precipitate moving through the new acidic water so that it forms kernels, if you will, where the precipitate generates more nodules, that is less dissolved in sort of a water matrix. So the water drains very well out of this and leaves fairly high density sludge with perhaps only 50% or less water content in the sludge. I hope that answers the questions. I can't be any more specific than that right now.
Okay. No, I think that was good, Kevin. Just real quick, Gene, if you're on while we're addressing those last few questions, would you mind moving up the last slide deck so people can see where to do feedback and information about the next webinar?
Absolutely.
So, Kevin, we have a questioner who wants to know what type of facility accepts the sludge for disposal.
Well, because of the fairly high arsenic levels in the adit treatment, we take that to a hazardous facility in either California or Nevada. The other sludges don't trigger that designation, so we take it to a relatively lower class disposal facility. There was some consideration of using some of the material for soil amendment for some of the farms in the alkaline areas of dry land farming in Nevada, but we haven't gotten to a stage where we're comfortable with that yet.
Okay. There's someone who's curious about your beavers. They didn't quite understand how the beavers are changing the water chemistry. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. What used to happen is the water would flow over the top of a low area that had essentially been filled in by several yards deep thickness of material that had washed off of the mine. And when the creek was flowing over the top of that, there wasn't time for a lot of chemical reactions to occur. What has happened is the beavers, like the aspen in that area, and they've built their dams, and we've got maybe 15 to 20 different beaver ponds now that are covering that precipitate and waste material, have changed it back from relatively aerobic conditions to anoxic conditions. The sulfur is going back into to acidic conditions. And some of those ponds, instead of being circumneutral pH as the discharges are, they're down to a pH of about 3. And that's redissolving some of the minerals that we really don't want to be in the dissolved form to feed back into the downstream area.
Well, great. I think we're coming up pretty much to the closing time that we allotted for this CLUIN webinar on mining sites. I want to thank Kevin and Jim and Brady for their wonderful presentation, as do many people who are commenting in the Adobe Connect room are just giving praise and how beneficial and how they learned a lot from your presentations today. So again, I really thank you for your time, and I'm glad that you could be a part of this series, and I'm really glad that we had the three of you speak together, because I think you complemented each other very well. I just want to, for the last closing slides, I just want to let everyone know that we're planning our next webinar for sometime in the spring of this year. And on this slide, you can see a link to our events page, where we not only compile information about our webinars, but we try to get current conferences and meetings related to mining up on that site, too. So I encourage you to visit that website. I also want to let everyone know that as a special addition to our series of webinars on CLUIN, we're having some workshops on hard rock mine geochemistry and hydrology. It's a series of three workshops that are being sponsored by EPA's Region 10 office, our Office of Research and Development, and our headquarters office, specifically my division. And here are the three workshops that are coming up. We do have one on February 13th, which is next week, I believe. There's a link to the registration page if you'd like to participate in that webinar also. And then here's some dates for the next two workshops after that, of which the registration will open after the 13th. With that, I wonder, Jean, if you want to take the last two slides and maybe talk about some of the participation today and any other closing remarks you might need.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm happy to. So I want to thank everybody who was able to join us, our organizers who joined us from a number of institutions, as well as the over 320 people who signed in from locations all across the United States and several other international guests joining us as well. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and we do want you to know that the staff like myself and Michelle are actually the power behind the Cleanup Information or CLUIN website. So we'd encourage you to take a look at some of our other resources and some of the websites and information that Michelle's already highlighted. Again, you can find us at CLUIN, CLUIN.org. If you're also part of popular social professional networking sites like Facebook, LinkedIn, or Twitter, I'd encourage you to take a look and connect with us there. I do have a couple of final closeout reminder items I'll cover for everyone today. If you'd like to take a look at the complete list of resources that were discussed during today's session, including copies of the PowerPoint presentation materials and a number of other websites, I'd encourage you to take a look at the additional resource page. You should now see an additional window that appears on the right side of your screen within Adobe Connect. It's called the Related URLs window. And there are four websites that are up. You'll find the seminar homepage, again, this resources page, a link to our feedback form, and then a link to our other archived seminars on CLUIN. Any one of the participants can click on those URLs and then press the Browse To button from within Adobe Connect to open up the websites locally. If you find that you want to refer back to those websites or resources when you're not here live in the online room, you can simply go back to the seminar homepage. And on that seminar homepage, the same place you were directed when you signed up and when you went to access slides or join us today, you'll find that collection of additional resources. Again, it's linked on the left and the bottom of the page. There's also a link to our short feedback form. Again, you'll find it on the related URL pod to the right. You'll also find it on the seminar homepage after today's live delivery. We do ask if you could take just a minute or so to fill out that short feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's session. If you shared the line with multiple individuals, each person can actually fill out their own feedback form. You know, once you fill the form out once, there'll be a link that'll allow the next person to hop on and fill out their own form. Again, you can come back to that form if you don't have time now. The form will be up and active indefinitely after our live delivery. For those of you who are hoping to earn credit for your participation today, such as through CEUs or PEHs, we don't necessarily offer those on CLUIN. But we have had participants simply keep a copy of their registration, a copy of the presentation materials, along with a confirmation message that they'll receive after submitting feedback, and use that to earn credit. So again, if you fill out feedback, you can check a box which is circled on the slide and have a confirmation message sent to you for your own records. Today's session was recorded and will automatically be archived on CLUIN. Each of you, when you signed up, will also get a reminder notice as soon as that archive is available. It usually takes us about 1 week or so. So you'll automatically get a note from us via email to let you know when that archive is available for free replay. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for everybody. So Michelle, any closing statements before we close out our seminar?
No, I think that's good, that we're good. I just want to thank everyone for their participation. And again, our wonderful presentations that were delivered by our three speakers.
Great. Thank you so very much. Well, this will be the formal conclusion for today's Kluwen seminar. I hope you have a great rest of your